football on off the ball.
If you took the rules today and applied them to the Leeds-Liverpool games, we'd have finished... Well, Johnny wouldn't have been on the pitch. Billy wouldn't have been on the pitch.
Join in the obsession.
Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
It's the morning after a bombastic weekend of sport. Loads to talk about, but the Kevin Keegan news has really dominated the headlines, and rightly so. Joined this morning, as always, by Enda, good morning.
Morning, Colm.
Dara Smith-Nocton is here too.
Colm.
And for the first time this week, Matthew Brennan. Morning, lads.
Colm, how are you?
Are you well?
Sorry.
Very sad. Very sad.
Yeah, very sad. Came very quickly as well. I know this news came out a couple of months ago, and then a couple of weeks ago, very suddenly, it came out that it was going to happen quite soon. So it's not an unexpected news, but it is still very sad, and it's a very big loss to the football community. I think Kevin Keegan is someone, regardless of your generation, is someone that is associated with being a football guy and a football man, and someone who was around at the top level for a very, very long time, both as a footballer and as a manager, and somebody who's widely spoken about as, like, not so much a gentleman on the pitch as a player, but very much a gentleman off the pitch, and someone who is respected widely by everyone who came across him. So very, very sad loss.
Yeah. Talk about maximising your life, what you had of it. You know, 75 is relatively young these days, yeah, but he did an awful lot. Like, I was just reading up on him again last night to remind you, because I don't know, like, we're all in different stages of life, but he's a quintessential part of my childhood. Like, I remember Kevin Keegan, the manager at Newcastle, and I loved that team. That one in 1995-96, there were 12 points ahead that I would love to rant. Even throughout that time at Newcastle, when they sold Andy Cole to Manchester United, I don't know if you've ever seen that clip, and he's on the steps at St James's Park, and he's explaining to fans why he sold them. And he was like, don't worry, we have people coming through. They brought in Les Ferdinand. And then in the summer of 96, after the Euros, they signed Alan Shearer. And he does this amazing speech in the press conference talking about how much it means to bring back a hometown hero. And he's like, all the money that you're investing as fans, this is what it's going into. It's like a rousing response. And then Shearer speaks. He just had something about him. But he released a single. He was in the show Superstars. His Liverpool's first European Cup was won with him up front. He was Germany's highest paid player. Ballon d'Or consecutively. Mm. Dara, as you reminded us this morning, came second the year before he won it for the first time.
Crazy, like.
Amazing. The Newcastle promotion when he got the job as manager, and then contending for the Premier League title. And when he retired from playing in Newcastle, he got a helicopter out of the pitch. He was a man of theatrics and fame. If you look at the European Cup at Liverpool, he had the sunglasses on and the flannel shirt.
Yeah.
At the same time, he was kind of humble. I don't know what your memories are of him.
Yeah, it's a strange one, because I think you hit the nail on the head there with the you said there he had something about him. Like, there is just, he had, like, there was an intangible kind of draw, like, an allure to him. And as you say, like, you would have been your childhood and remember that Newcastle team and all. Would have been a bit before, I suppose, me existing. But, like, growing up, I think, I'm, what, 22 now, so, I mean, imagine people of my age would have had a similar sort of experience growing up watching, I hope this doesn't come across in the wrong way, but, like, watching Premier League years on Sky Sports and getting to see football from so long ago, and, like, Kevin Keegan even as a player, and then into being a manager, and he is the face of that for me. Like, when I think about watching that growing up, he is the first person that I think of, and the post-match interviews and watching him on the line and that kind of, I don't know, is rivalry a fair way to put it, but just when you think about that era at Manchester United as well with Sir Alex, it's like he's the main protagonist in a weird sort of way. So he definitely, I'll go back to what I said at the start, but he absolutely had something about him, and he's someone as well that, despite not being in the limelight in the same way a lot of people of that vintage have been in the last couple of years, he's still someone that would constantly kind of be on your mind. And it's easy to say that now, I suppose, when this has happened, but he definitely is someone that is crossed generations as far as being a character, outside of being an absolutely unbelievable footballer and a fairly successful manager too. I mean, he's left his imprint absolutely everywhere he's been.
There's I was only, funny enough, just thinking about this exact moment here for people who are watching on YouTube this morning. It's Keegan strangling Alex Ferguson. That's the summer of 1996. That's really a matter of weeks after I would love it rant. That's when they threw the league away and Man United won it. And that was Kevin Keegan in a nutshell. Like, he would move on very quickly from any dispute he had.
That's cool. That's what I mean when I said, like, I don't know his rivalry the right word, because it's,
in the moment.
It's a footballing
thing. A moment
thing,
of passion, and then he's back to being Kevin Keegan.
Yeah, it's funny, like, because Matthew, I'm a similar age to you, so my abiding memory of him was the I Love It rant watching Premier League years 95, 96 back in the day.
Yeah.
But it's such a disservice to him and his career, because as a Man United fan, I watched that being like, you know, watching that rant, like Alex Ferguson's gotten in his head here. But you went through his playing career there. I listened to the, it was a lovely tribute that Liverpool put out on their socials yesterday. And it's him narrating his entire career. And he talks about coming from Scunthorpe and Bill Shankly offering him, I think, £40 a week or something crazy, which is like £700 in today's terms. And I suppose over the years, you just learn about, you learn a bit more about the people, through speaking to people like yourself, Colm, or people in this office that would have, you know, seen him play or seen him manage when he was doing that. And he's just an absolute legend and a trailblazer in many cases as well. You know, going to Hamburg, winning his two Ballon d'Ors, not something that was too common at the time. Like you said, being the highest paid player in Germany. And yeah, just he just lived a few lives, didn't he?
Yeah, well, he worked for it too. Like, this was, you know, Kenny Dalglish replaced him at Liverpool as a player. And then he went on to replace him at Newcastle as a manager dramatically in 1997. But Keegan himself said, there's a really interesting interview of him floating around from yesterday. It's like, he was probably the most limited player to win the Ballon d'Or, and he won it back to back because he had to work at his craft massively to really maximise everything that he possibly could. So, like, it's a clunky old comparison, but I suppose he was Ronaldo to Dalglish's Messi, and that he just worked on it all day long. But he maximised everything, as I said. Like, from Scunthorpe to Liverpool was a big old gamble, I suppose, for Liverpool. I mean, if it didn't work out, fair enough, whatever. But, like, they hadn't won a league in a long time when he joined.
It was 1965-66 was the last one.
They went several with him there, and himself and John Tashuk up front. Unbelievable partnership. Great header of the ball for a man who was relatively small. He's about 5'7 or something.
Amazing mullet as well.
Oh, yeah. Amazing incredible. Mullet. Unbelievable shape.
Incredible
shape. For his time.
Like, if you look back at some of the colour interviews of him back then, his biceps are really popping. Like, he was in incredible shape, and I do think he represents a standard and level of footballer back then that probably doesn't get the credit they deserve for the shape that they were in. I mean, there's this almost falsity of modern football analysis that everything back then was slow and they were pretty much amateur footballers and they were only fit for their time. But, like, there were people like Kevin Keegan. Like, you look at him on a pitch and you look at the shape that he was in, and he was a professional athlete in the realest terms. And I was looking through some of his training regime. Like, he would work off the pitch outside of training. Like, there's stories of him grabbing dumbbells and doing laps of stairs straight after training to get even more cardio. And, like, it just goes to show, like, it pays off. Like, when he went to Liverpool, they hadn't won a title since 65. He goes there 71. They win three league titles, a European Cup, two Super Cups, and an FA Cup. And then he goes to Hamburg, who had never won a Bundesliga title at the time. He goes there in 77. And they win the Bundesliga title in 77, 78, and 79. He wins two Ballon d'Ors. And he sort of brings that into management as well. Like, his management career is exceptional. He has an exceptional record, and he clearly had a wonderful football mind as well. But one thing that is interesting about him and is that, like, a lot of people mention George Best in terms of, like, modern day footballers. Who created the modern day footballer? And George Best was, like, this first celebrity footballer, and he was a trailblazer. But Kevin Keegan was a real trailblazer, and I'll bring you some clips with Johnny Giles now in a second, but Johnny Giles credits Kevin Keegan with fixing football to put the power in the hands of the players, because when he left Liverpool, that wasn't something that was normal. He had a release clause inserted into his contract that allowed him to leave Liverpool, because at the time, when you signed a contract with a club, you were essentially signing a lifetime contract. Like, you had to wait for a club to buy you out of that. And it was at the club's discretion whether or not that you would leave. But he was managed by a guy called Harry Swales, who went on to manage Ryan Giggs as well. And he got this release clause put into his contract that if somebody pays 500 grand for him, away you go. Off he went. Yeah. It wasn't popular with Liverpool. The Liverpool chairman at the time cursed him out of it for his final year. He told Liverpool he was going to leave, but he was like discarded by the club. His wages then increases from 12,000 to 250,000 a year. from Liverpool to Hamburg. That's the difference. That's the change that he makes. So, like, and at one stage he speaks about getting a phone call to go to Saudi Arabia, and he said he would go for £1 million a year. Ring me back at Christmas. So, sorry, one more thing on the Hamburg contract. He gets a face deal put into his contract. One of the first players ever, potentially the first footballer ever, to have his own imaging rights, control those. So then he starts doing merchandising. Mm. So he changes the world of football in a very, very real way for footballers to put power in their hands. Because, like, we're talking about an era here where, like, in the build-up to the World Cup, you always get Jeff Hurst rolled out for the media when they're talking about the England team. That England team that won the 66 World Cup, they sold all their stuff because they were broke after football. And we hear about it all the time. You hear about, like, Nobby Styles. Loads of players of that era sold off all the stuff that they had because they went broke after football. Kevin Keegan changed that. So that's a real impact.
Mm. You talk about legacy as well. That's something that came up last week on the show. He's left a legacy.
Mm.
There's no disputing that. And that's one of the things. It's like he was probably the first player to really, really market himself outside of George Best, maybe. To really understand that he should be valued.
I see this trend online at the moment, right, of younger people saying the Beatles are overrated, right? They're listening back now for the first time, right? The Beatles are overrated, right?
I never said
it's
that.
Like,
I quite like the Beatles.
You like Leo? A lot of people saying it like me. Yeah, but I was thinking, because they, you know, everyone kind of sounds like them now, right? But it was like at the time, the Beatles were insane. Like, that was like unbelievable.
And people Kevin couldn't believe Keegan, what they were hearing.
Kevin Keegan's conditioning and his ability to market himself was not common at all at the time. Now you look back, he was a famous footballer and whatever, but like he was kind of a self-employed business person and a footballer. And Phil Thompson was on with the lads last night on the news round, and he talked about that, like that nobody had an agent.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was flying private jets.
And at the same time...
His family, when he lived in Hamburg, his family lived in England, and he was flying over and back. That never happened.
Never a thing. And at the same time, like, not a great environmentalist, Kevin Keegan. No. But that wasn't a thing at the time. And at the same time, private jet, right? And again, if you look at him after the European Cup win, like the shirt, the sunglasses, he's carrying himself like a superstar. People talk about his humility all the time.
Mm.
The way that thing there where the incident where they sell Andy Cole and he takes to the steps just to explain it to the Newcastle fans. Now, cynically, it's always a bit performative, whatever, because cameras were there. But he literally takes time to talk to them. It's like Mike Bassett, the manager, when he listens to the fans outside the bus. And then he's like, fuck off. And then Kevin Keegan's is listening. He's like, I hear you. I hear why you did it. But trust me, this is why I did it. And he was nearly vindicated by selling Andy Cole, because they should have won the league.
They should have. Matthew, go ahead.
Yeah, no, sorry. I just triggered a memory there. A comment there, Aaron Mack is saying the man brought Peter Schmeichel to Manchester City. That's got to be a testament to his personality when you'd forever taint your United legacy to play for him. Now, there's obviously a few different factors in there in that Peter Schmeichel didn't leave United on the best of terms and all that sort of stuff. But I actually watched a documentary that Schmeichel did. It was one of the Sky Sports ones there a couple of weeks or months ago. And it was like I remember they were talking about it. He had like a 20-minute conversation with Keegan. And I'd say that's something that has translated across, like, you know, when you were saying he's standing on the steps and he's saying we've got all these players coming and we're going to do this, that and the other. And I'm sure one of the reasons, money aside, that the players came was because there was someone like this who obviously had such an effect on people that I'll go and play for him, I want to play for him. And then even David Holton said in the comments there that the reason he started following Newcastle was because of Kevin Keegan. Like, and when you talk about legacy, like, there's a legacy in itself. When in an era now where, you know, kids today look at players and they look at like Ronaldo and they look at Messi and they look at whoever and they say, I'm going to follow him around, I'm going to follow that. When he goes and signs for another club, I'm going to support them, I'm going to follow the player. That's something that wasn't a thing back then. So when you've got a guy who is over a club and is having such a such a way about him that people are like, it's you, I want you, whatever you are, and then in turn you fall in love with the club and he moves on, that's how it goes. Like that's a legacy, that's a proper legacy.
Well, his life was a movie, like, because the way he left Newcastle just out of the blue midway through the following year where they blew the league, 1996-97, he had just signed Alan Shearer. It was Shearer and Big Les. They had hammered Man United 5-0 at St James's Park. Philippe Albert, one of the most glorious lobs you'll ever see on Schmeichel, and he leaves a couple of months later because of the dispute of the club. The way he left England resigns in the shower at the old Wembley after losing to Germany, and it's pissing it down rain, and he has the tracksuit over his hand, and he's just, I'm not good enough to do this job anymore. There was a drama to him, but somehow a relatability at the same time. You have a few stuff?
I have a few bits. Yeah, so if you ever are stuck for something to watch, this 45-minute interview is available on YouTube. It's an interview with Brian Muir, who, you know, anything he touches is fantastic. And it's with Kevin Keegan when he was at Hamburg. And it covers a lot of his career and a lot of his feelings at the time, his feelings with England. Learning the German language, searching for British cereal when he went over to Germany and struggling to adjust initially and with the team and with the language, with the culture. But this is at the very, very end where he talks about what's the end of his career going to look like. And it's very, very interesting. You'll see during this clip, there's a short period where he's out in a balcony at Hamburg. You'll see the star quality that he had in the city. But this is Kevin Keegan speaking to Brian Muir. I think this was back in 78.
I have no inclination at all to stay in football. I'd love to be a politician, I think. Really interests me. I'd love to have a little bit to do with with our destiny, really. These people have got so much power. And yet, at the same time, I think you would probably find when you got in there... I mean, I wouldn't like just to be a politician, I'd like to be Prime Minister. I wouldn't want to mess around with the little bits and bobs. I'd like to have the power, you know. I'm going to play till the 82 World Cup. I've been lucky in life that most of my dreams have come true, and I hope this one does too. My dream is to, in 1982 in Spain, to win the World Cup for England and go up there and lift the trophy up and then say to the world, well, you know, thanks for what? It'll be 12 great years, but this is where I want to finish while I'm at the top, and you can't get more at the top than that. That's my dream. I've been dead lucky, you know, like when I come to Liverpool, my dream was to win the league. Then my dream was to play for England. Then my dream was to captain England. And then when I came to Hamburg, you know, although I never thought it possible, my dream was that Hamburg won the league here. Now my dream is that Hamburg win the European Cup next year. And my last dream is that England win the World Cup final. And I'd like to hold the trophy up, but that's not that important. You know, if I'm not skipper, I'm not skipper. But that is my dream. And if them dreams come off, then, you know, well, I'm probably one of the few people in the world that's had all the dreams come true. Well, nearly all of them, anyway.
That's brilliant. He doesn't achieve his dream at that World Cup, but, I mean, he did pretty much everything else.
He's so softly spoken.
It's the laid back. As
yeah,
the
he's
couch.
Literally lying down. It's amazing. Amazing insight. Like, just...
Sums up Keegan as, I don't want to be a politician, I want to be Prime Minister.
Yeah.
I don't want to do that a little bit.
Such a great line.
All the way to the
top. That's Keegan in a nutshell, isn't it?
Absolutely.
I want the power.
It should be mentioned as well that he played in an era where, like, he's a small guy.
Yeah.
And it wasn't exactly an easy era of football to play in. And he was a phenomenal footballer. And these two clips we're going to bring you now is the famous punch between Kevin Keegan and John Giles. So we'll play the punch out first here. So this is in the Charity Shield between Leeds United and Liverpool, and our very own John Giles is heavily involved here.
Quickly. That's amazing. Sorry, the fact the commentator shows that looks like a right hook from Johnny Giles, as if it's like, you know, a sliding tackle.
Innocuous.
It happens very commonly, yeah.
It was innocuous.
It meant how quickly he gets back up. I mean, we just watch Argentina.
And I'll make great as blush.
Absolutely outrageous display of whatever the hell that was. And I know it's just the era, that's the time it was, but you just got a right hook flush to the chin and he's like, yeah.
A FIFA launching an investigation with Argentina Spain. They'd shut football down after that.
I'll get back up. Would you believe that John Jazz didn't even get booked for that?
Yeah.
I would believe that probably, yeah.
In that match, it was 1974, Billy Bremner and Kevin Keegan also got sent off in the match.
Oh, wow.
Kevin Keegan punches Billy Bremner later on in the game. So they famously, they both take off their tops and throw them on the ground. But we did speak to John Jazz about this a couple of times throughout his time with Off the Ball. And this clip that we're going to bring you is from his 80th birthday. We threw a bash for Johnny here in the studio and... we surprised them with Kevin Keegan on the line and the punch comes up.
Coming back to the Wembley thing, I seem to remember you punching me. And I think it was Bob Matthewson was the referee.
No, you were right. I did punch you. But can you remember what happened before that? Can you remember the
I can't remember what happened after you punched me. I can't remember too much.
Let's go back on it. It didn't happen by accident. You had a terrible tackle on Norman Hunter. You had a terrible tackle on Billy Bremner. The ball broke loose, and you're all over me. And I let you go past, and I did punch. I should have gone on off. No doubt, I'm not trying to make excuses wrong. Who's the referee, Kevin?
Bob Matthewson.
Yes. Well, I always got on well with him. And when you were on the ground, I'm apologising to Matt and say, sorry about that, I didn't mean it. And he let me off. There's no doubt
when
I should have gone off.
When you hit me, he said, he's so friendly with you, he said to me, don't do that to him again. And you hit me.
Yeah.
Bob Matthewson.
Kevin, can I just say, in the controversy overall, when you were sent off, along with Billy, you took your jersey off and threw it on the ground, and so did Billy. Right? You remember that, don't you?
Yeah, I remember that. It was a lovely hot day.
All I'm saying is that had nothing to do with me. Because any time I played at Liverpool afterwards, I got unbelievable stick for that particular incident with you. Quite rightly as well.
I forgot how amazing that is.
Ah, it's so good.
Like, why is he talking about like it happened last week?
That's what I'm saying. It's like as if he's brought it up to say, you're going to get a retrospective ban here. You're not going to be able to play at the weekend.
You started it.
Yeah. That had nothing to do with me. When Dermot Keenan points out that they got 10 game bans off the back of that because they took their tops off. Bremner and Keegan.
That's so funny.
Oh, that's amazing. The child's so defensive. Like,
I watched that a couple of times this morning when I was putting together. And I laughed each and every time John Giles goes, yeah, I did punch you. I did. There's also, before we went on, we did have Jazzy on like a couple of months before that in studio talking about that. And he goes into it in detail. It's well worth your listen and your watch. If you want to go back and see it, it's on the Off the Ball YouTube.
Obviously dominating the headlines this morning. It's actually the front page of the Irish Examiner. It's just a picture of Kevin Keegan with the 1977 European Cup.
That says a lot, doesn't it?
Oh, it's unbelievable. Yeah. Back page of the Times UK, a truly great player, a truly inspirational person, which is a pretty good summary of him. Only one Kevin Keegan at the back of the Mirror Sport there posing in his Liverpool kit. King Kev, football and mourning as game bids farewell to iconic Keegan. The back of the Irish Daily Star Sports section. All-time greats on sport. Sorrow as game mourns a hero. And then a lovely picture, black and white. The same one actually that the Irish Examiner went with. 1977 European Cup in the eye. Kevin Keegan, 1951 to 2026. Two-time Ballon d'Or winning former England captain and manager who won European Cup at Liverpool, dies age 75. And just one more actually. The Irish Daily Mail. Kevin Keegan, there was no legal way of stopping him.
That's brilliant.
That's a great line.
That's where Giles just encapsulated that, didn't he?
Yeah, I saw many members. I might want to say as him slumped over in that 4-3, iconic 4-3 in April 1996.
Yeah, there's the board, something. Boarding,
I just love that when he slumped over. I just know why there's something about it. And he looks, and I think it's Terry McDermott to his left. That might have been the time that Mark Lawrenson was on his coaching staff, actually, because we'll speak with Laro later about it live on the show. I just love that when he's slumping. There was just something so honest about him.
It's so emotional, but so relatably emotional. Like it's proper.
I just love him. I must go back. I'm probably going to go down an old trip there now later on. I can't believe that's all 30 years ago, like bang on 30 years since he did the I Love It. he passes away.
The Ballon d'Or is mentioned a few times in the papers there, just to kind of put that into perspective a little bit. It's easy to kind of get muddled up with the eras and like who was around at that time, but I was just going through obviously the years that he's won it here in 78 and 79 and just a few years before. So like 1974, Johan Cruyff wins it. 1973, Cruyff wins it. 72, Franz Beckenbauer wins it. 76, Beckenbauer wins it. He comes second in 1977 and in third place is Michel Platini. You know, you've got Karl-Heinz Rummenigge winning back to back in 80 and 81. You've got Paolo Rossi in 82. Like, these are some of the greatest players that have ever existed, and he's right in amongst it, if, ahead of most of them across these years. Like, you know, it's the Ballon d'Or is one of these things that I think only really properly became a thing, you know, that people took real appreciation for in the Messi Ronaldo kind of eras.
But, definitely. But Michael Owen got it.
Yeah, exactly.
100%.
Yeah. So it's I think it's just important to highlight who's around at those times. Like, you know, it's mad.
I think at the time, he was only one of the first people to win back to back.
Yeah.
Alfredo Di Stefano and Beckenbauer might have done it.
It's funny.
Yeah, Steve went through it last night, I think, in the news round. Yeah. It's a crazy list. I look back in his England tenure with kind of fondness of it. Because he took over from Glenn Hoddle, of course, who left very controversially. He was only there a year and a half, or just over, Euro 2000. It's never really worked out for him. Like, they had that Portugal game. Luis Figo scores a cracker from way out. I think they're 2-0 up in that game. It's 2-2. Maybe Portugal wins 3-2. Anyway, it's not a great tournament. And the way he just walks away from the England job, no one forced him out. They lost to Germany. I think it was the last game at the old Wembley and it was bucking it down in rain. Our own Didi Haman got the winning goal. It was a free that David Seaman should have saved. And then Keegan says, I can't do the job anymore. I think he got the England job off managing Fulham. And I have no recollection of a stint at Fulham at all. And with Man City, he brings them up and they score over 100 goals.
Yeah.
Gets him into Europe for the first time in 24 years in the Premier League. Newcastle were flirting with relegation to the third tier of English football when he took over. Brings them up. So he's this great player who goes from Scunthorpe all the way to the top, wins everything in the game at club level, scores, what is it, 20 odd goals in 60 odd games for England?
21 goals in 63 caps, which doesn't feel like a lot of caps for a player of his stature.
And in management, he peaks with bringing sides up to the Premier League, should have won the Premier League, but still achieved all that. And yet, my abiding memory of it slumped over.
Yeah.
Just love it.
He, I was reading there, he's been promoted as champions with the three different clubs he managed, he got promoted.
Amazing. What's it say about him? This power of motivation to get the most out of people.
Yeah.
That's like he was himself. Yeah. Something else, keep your tributes coming into Kevin Keegan. We'll read out as many as possible throughout the show. In the meantime, it's 7:58 a.m. on this Tuesday morning. Should we do a bit more on the World Cup? That was the plan today, actually, talk about the World
Cup. That was the plan,
I have a few edits to make, actually. I was corrected yesterday, rightly so, that I said that it was the first 0-0 World Cup final. Since 94, right? I've been corrected, 2010 and 2014 back to back. I mean, give me a break. I have a newborn at home.
Yeah,
I have a toddler too. Sleep is an old friend I used to know. You know, it's going to happen a lot, right? I got this stat as well, right? From, where did this come from? The FIFA website. How about this, right?
Oh.
The top scorers at the World Cup this year.
Yeah.
France and England. Most conceded, team with the most conceded, England. Tunisia and Iraq.
It's a damning indictment on Tunisia and Iraq, considering they played three games.
They're on minus 11 and minus 10 goal difference, respectively.
Yeah, the England defence, I suppose they did concede four against France in the third place playoff.
They did.
So.
And they scored six, you know. So, yeah. And you were talking about leaving all the talent behind. Did they score a lot of goals, England?
Well, I'm sure all of their goals really were up until, I suppose, Gordon and Rashford got one each, didn't they? And outside of that was Bellingham and Kane, who got, was it 7 and 6 apiece or 8 and 6 apiece? So you're heavily reliant on players. Now, there's nothing totally wrong with that, I suppose.
Yeah.
But when you're, it's not a plan.
Do you think, know? Right, that Tuchel managed Bellingham very well because he pissed him right off? Remember before the first game, do you remember before the Croatia match, was like, there was a call for you to make, Thomas, when he was interviewed pre-match. Was it going to be Rodgers or Bellingham? And I was like, I just shaded for Bellingham. And that was not an absurd conversation to have at the time. And weeks later, it was like, geez, without Jude Bellingham, England would have been screwed.
Yeah.
I mean, it's impossible to tell whether it was on purpose or not.
That's the thing. Like, it's worked out well, so you have to credit him for that. But, you know, in the same breath, it might not have worked out well. So I'm not sure. I do think, and I said this at the time when Bellingham came out after the game and he was obviously asked about what Tuchel had said, and obviously, whatever, granted, he hadn't heard exactly what Tuchel had said. about them not playing particularly well.
Mm.
I didn't think at the time that that was Tuchel trying to get the, like, saying that because he knew that Bellingham would take it a certain way and, you know, use it as fuel to go and play well. I don't think they like each other. Yeah, but that's not necessarily the worst thing in the world, you know.
I was just thinking about that yesterday, you know.
Do you think they've underachieved? Because I have a feeling that they actually
did
as good as they probably should.
They remind me of the Irish rugby team. They're about that.
Okay.
They're about like fourth or fifth best in the world, but there are better teams. And just because of the fortunes and riches of the Premier League, it's like, oh, you think that they should win the Premier League.
Yeah.
It's not that simple. And their two best players don't play in the Premier League.
Well, yeah, that's true, yeah. There shouldn't really be an expectation for them to make a World Cup final. They're not in the best two, top. They're not in the top two nations in the world.
I just think it's resources that people think they should.
Yeah, and they're paying a foreign manager an extraordinary amount of money to come in. And
it's a weird one. They were close, obviously, but at the same time, sure, like, who do they beat on the way?
Yeah,
but, you know, there's nothing special.
Yeah, but then when you're reaching, see, this is the thing, like, when you're reaching European finals on a regular basis, you're reaching World Cup quarterfinals and semifinals on a regular basis, there comes a point where you have to make that step, and them appointing Thomas Tuchel was the step that they thought they needed to make to get to the final and go that one or two steps.
A bit naive, though. Like, he hasn't managed in international football. Like, was he going to get to a World Cup in his first major tournament?
Well, I think maybe they hired him for tournament football because he gets PSG, doesn't he, to the 2020 Champions League final.
It's a completely different thing, though.
Wins it with Chelsea.
Wins it with Chelsea, yeah, the year after. So it's two finals in a row. So I guess they're trying to channel that spirit.
That'd be a very impressive feat for him to reach a World Cup final in his major tournament.
That 2020 Champions League final was like a World Cup format because it was only one-off games. There was no two legs during COVID. I guess they're trying to channel something that happened before. But it's very hard to have a ready-made international manager.
Mm. Yeah.
They're difficult to acquire.
Is there an argument to be
really
made
exist.
That
not
that similar to the Man United Mourinho era that Man United were just too late with it. They were too late with Mourinho. They got him at his worst possible stage. And there might be this idea, not because of where Tuchel's at in his career, but where this England squad is at, that they were too late with the Thomas Tuchel era because they wasted time with Gareth Southgate. They had the best possible England team under Southgate and didn't get over the line, whether it was his fault, whether it was players' fault, probably somewhere in between. But does Thomas Tuchel take the team that Gareth Southgate had in 2022 to a World Cup title when they're all at their peak? This squad is weaker now than it was in 2022.
That's by Tuchel's choice, though, in fairness. He's dropped a lot of those players.
And I think in 2022 as well, it's probably the one tournament that I wouldn't blame Southgate at all for, in that they went out to France and Harry Kane skied a penalty. I think he managed that game pretty well.
He did, yeah. Did you hear Southgate talk about the Euros 24 there recently? It was like, even after the Dutch game when they won the semi-final, it was like he felt no joy because he knew the supporters wanted him gone.
Yeah.
The crack was done before the final even occurred. Yeah. And I just had an idea there. Do you want to pick your best 11 for World Cup?
You just had this idea. Well, it's funny. I had this idea yesterday and I did pick my team. Knowing that you would have this idea in your head.
Telepathy.
First, I should say that Off the Ball Breakfast is with Braeburn. Whether the Irish summer is a scorcher or serving up some summer showers, Braeburn Coffee has the perfect iced coffee, from refreshing iced mochas to iced lattes. Whatever the weather, Braeburn Coffee has you covered, available exclusively at Apple Green, made for your summer. So do you want to hear?
I hope you had
that made my summer.
A big pot of Braeburn before you made this team now, because you're liable to get a few coarse opinions from across the room and across the comments.
Across the room,
And that's absolutely fair. I'll take them all. I should say that one of my picks wasn't in my pick for the best players playing at the tournament when we did this earlier on with Shane Hannon at the start of the tournament. You'll know immediately because it's my number one choice. And it's my goalkeeper, Unai Simon.
Yeah.
Is the goalkeeper of the tournament in my eyes. I actually felt that David Raya was probably the best goalkeeper at the World Cup in terms of talent.
But
he's a different type of goalkeeper than Unai Simon, and maybe David Raya, the style of goalkeeper he is, isn't suited to the way that Spain want their goalkeeper to play.
This is a question you don't have the answer to, Ender, but I'll ask it.
My favourite type.
How do you think David Raya receives that World Cup medal?
Well, given the videos of him scaling the goals and almost choking himself to death with his medal, I think he enjoyed it.
It's a tough one, isn't it?
I think he enjoyed it.
When you don't play a second.
Yeah.
I think it's
for a goalkeeper.
I think it's different for a keeper. Yeah, because keepers have this sort of like they're a team. Like they are the man that's in goal for a national team. You know, David Raya is Unai Simon. They are all the one. But I think when like for likes of Kobbie Mainoo, if England had gone on to win it, it's a bit like it's grand. Like you know, but it's also different if you're old because if Jordan Henderson didn't play a minute and they go and win it, he's loving that because it's like this is the end of my career. David Raya is an interesting case study because he's in the middle of his career. But I think goalkeepers they take a collective joy in.
Yeah,
in one doing well for the national team. For clubs, it's different, I think.
You said this as a goalkeeper yourself. Union, you know.
One of minor championship.
Zubimendi's first minutes in the World Cup was in the final, right? Big pang of Chris Baird. Do you remember him, the defender for Southampton? His first game for Southampton was the FA Cup final, 2003. There he was looking at the medal afterwards, like, this is class.
Yeah.
So for Zubimendi, that's a good feeling. Your only minutes are in the final.
Yeah.
I'd like to talk to a professional about that. What's that like?
That's an interesting conversation. Well, yeah.
Roy Keane speaks about
famously,
that.
Ender.
And
does that have any joy for that man?
No. And it's totally fair. Like you can understand where he's coming from.
I think he's being absurd to himself.
I think he's just a actual
look what he did
top level
look what he did in the
mentality.
Semi-final.
Yeah. Anyway, Unai Simon, I thought he was phenomenal. New Manuel Neuer with his exploits outside of the goal, as opposed to actually like making any real saves. You would say,
yeah, fair enough.
He did most of his defensive work actually came like through his head or through his feet, as opposed to actually being a goalkeeper. They conceded one goal throughout the tournament.
Yeah,
can you remember who scored it?
Charles de Ketelera, however you say his name. I have no idea how to pronounce that. John Duggan had a tweet up last night about it. It went viral, asking who scored the goal.
Yeah,
people. To be fair, weirdly enough, were replying but not spoiling it. Just
I won't lie to you.
How good of a question it was.
I did steal that question from JD. Just there.
There you go.
All right, my back four. I've gone for a 4-2-3-1 just to keep it simple. I've gone for Pedro Porro at right back.
Okay,
what a glow up the guy's had.
Yeah,
you'd have to have paid me an obscene amount of money to predict that Pedro Porro would be in my team of the tournament for the right back, but he was phenomenal. He was really, really good.
He was.
Kubarsi is the first of my centre back.
Yeah.
Also brilliant, fantastic clearance in the final as well.
Yeah, for the ball came across. I don't remember who was actually coming in. It was Senesi
coming in,
weirdly, coming in behind him. Yeah, it was a brilliant clearance. He got young player of the tournament actually as well, Kubarsi. So
then we have, I didn't go for the full Spain defence, which I could have, but I went for Lisandro Martinez as the other centre back.
Ooh.
People will look back on this Argentina team with disdain because of the final. But let's not forget, they got to the final. Like, they are a really good team. And they disgraced themselves in the final. But defensively, they were solid. Martinez was really solid throughout. He got injured in the final, but...
Are you putting...
Barely put a foot wrong.
Are you putting him in there as, you know, a left-sided centre-half because he's left-footed? Or... do you think he was better than Christian Romero?
I think he was better than Christian Romero.
Okay.
Romero was very good.
Yeah.
There might be a little bit of bias in my head coming in with that left-footedness.
That's fine, yeah. I don't have too much of an issue. I think Argentina got to the final. You're going to have a player or two in there.
Yeah.
I would have gone for Romero myself, but I think Martinez is justifiable. It is pretty mad that they finished the game without both of their starting centre-halves, to be fair to them.
It is. And I was thinking back on the game, and... I was wondering why Lautaro Martinez didn't come off the bench, and it was probably because of that.
Yeah,
like they did bring Senesi off the bench, and that might impact them going forward with the inability to bring the other Martinez off the bench.
Yeah.
So then I do have worries with the left side of my defense with height, but I believe the aggression of these two players might. You know, might work well. Mark Cucurella.
He's class. He's so good. So good.
Defensively, just so strong. And he was not fantastic at the tail end of the season there. Like, he got exposed multiple times. So, really, like, surprising that he was so strong and so good defensively. Then, in the midfield, we've got Rodri.
Yeah.
Player of the tournament. Showing what he can do, showing why he is also a Ballon d'Or winner.
Yeah.
That is excellent. And then we've got Jude Bellingham.
Yep, hard to argue.
That's fair enough, yeah.
Do we think he played despite or to spite Thomas Tuchel?
I think he had a bit of a point to prove. I, th- I, maybe off the back of his club season as well. I don't think he had the best club season.
Yeah, he was grand. Like, he didn't have as good a season he had the season prior. That's a hard question to answer. I'd say he just played well for himself and England.
All right.
No, I think Tuchel pushed him. I definitely think he pushed him. I think he didn't want to get into his comfort zone and got a response from him. Is it Jude Bellingham? He's a weird player.
Yeah,
he's such a weird player to talk about. I mean, we talked with Graham Hunter about this, right? I had a bit of a back and forth to Graham Hunter. He was kind of like, you kind of need to see him play every week. I was like, I'm not going to see him every play every week, but I see him in the Champions League. And I'm like, sometimes I just think the guy's completely anonymous. He just does nothing in particular. Yeah. And then he'll single-handedly win you a game. And it's very few players that can do the latter part.
I think what really woke me up, because I would have had a similar sort of sentiment toward him, was the Mexico game. He was absolutely outrageous. One of the best individual performances I've seen in a long, long time, both offensively and defensively. Mm-hmm. Like, everything about what he did was remarkable. He was clearing balls off the line. He was making last-ditch tackles. He was scoring goals. He was winning the ball back. He was pressing. He played the entire game at altitude up front for a portion of it. He was absolutely ridiculous. So maybe I got a chance to see what Graham Hunter reckons he's doing every week with Real Madrid. But yeah, he's definitely worth his place in this team for
sure. Just a controversy-free team so far.
I think so. There might be an element of Jude Bellingham that he doesn't fit with modern football, and that, like, if you put him in the mid-2000s era, you might know exactly what he's about then, because we don't really have players like Jude Bellingham anymore. Yeah.
Where would he play in mid-2000s?
Like kind of the eight role, arriving late into the Frank Lampard Zidane style, or like Zidane is probably a better Lampard example, yeah. Like arriving late into the box, long marauding runs with the ball.
He's a unique profile, to be fair, because he's not a 6 and he's not a 10. And the bit in between doesn't properly exist, I don't think.
The Lampard comparison is definitely agree with it for the arriving late in the box, but Lampard was never dribbling with the ball the way that Bellingham does.
No, like, totally, yeah.
I haven't seen a centre mid dribble with the ball for England like that since probably Gaza.
He's so physically imposing as well, isn't he? He's a big lad too, I think.
He's a little bit beyond my period, but like when you see videos, Brian Robson is probably someone that you could maybe relate him to.
Yeah, I don't know if he was like that kind of talismanic figure. I don't know. It's a weird one. You saw his full ability against France in that final goal, where it's like, oh, if he wants to, this guy can just dribble around you.
Football.
I'm telling you, that game is a showcase of how actually talented all of these people are. When they don't really like care about what happens.
Baralisa.
And do whatever they want.
Baralisa.
But he's a shocker. When everyone started talking, whispering, is Baralisa the best player in the world?
Yeah.
After the Sweden game, where he was true ball after true ball, couldn't help but hit a class pass.
Yeah.
Ever since people have said that, he's getting dispossessed left and right.
Yeah, he was god awful against Spain.
Got in his head.
He was god awful against Spain, and then the England game was just, you know, he was the one playing the through balls. It was like on this occasion, he was the one on the end of the through balls and just kind of didn't know what to do and just kept putting the ball wide. It was just weird to see a player of that standard. My mother was watching a game with me, and she wouldn't have too much of an idea of who Michael Olise is. And
get him off.
She was like, "What's this fella doing on the pitch?" And I was like, "It's actually one of the best players in the world."
That's cutting. That's real cutting. Yeah, yeah. When the mother says it's cutting.
Well, speaking of Michael Olise, he has not made the team for those exact reasons. I've gone for an interesting selection in this remainder of my midfield.
What's our formation?
The obvious ones, 4-2-3-1.
4-2-3-1.
The obvious ones have made it. So, Lionel Messi.
Yeah.
Kylian Mbappe. The two top goal scorers at this World Cup.
Despite Messi's ghosting in the final, obviously.
Ooh. Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah,
39-year-old who's played every minute of every game so far.
Have the same energy.
And then the last player I've gone for, I've thrown in a wild card because it's a bit of fun, and nobody else really stood out as somebody who's like obviously needs to be in this team. I've gone for Julian Quiñones.
I like
Mexico.
I like it.
I don't hate it. I don't hate it at all.
Number 16. Was he the number 16?
Number 16.
Yeah.
Yeah. The winger.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Scored 4 goals for Mexico.
Scored against England.
Scored against England. He was their best player.
Yeah, he was.
And he was somebody who would have been those old school players that we didn't really know too much about him coming into this tournament, but we would come out thinking, God, there's a player that will play for Villarreal probably in the European Cup in a couple of years' time.
He scored like 40 goals over in Saudi Arabia last season. And
what's the quintessential club that signs a breakout player from a World Cup?
Hull. Watford.
Watford's great, yeah.
Yeah.
If in doubt, Watford's the answer, really, isn't it?
And Watford have a unique ability to have like a brand new player in the starting 11 every week.
And nobody knows
where
to
get
is.
Them from. How did they even get them?
And then sell them.
They're, like, just like,
sell them to Everton for 50.
He's on loan at Udinese. Yeah. It's funny as well because obviously they only got to the last 16, went out to England, but you look at the other left. Well, you look at I assume you've got him on the left hand side, do you? And that team, he's on the left, is he?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you look at the teams who got really far into the tournament. You look at Spain, and did Baena play on the left, who didn't really set the world alight. Argentina didn't kind of have anyone doing that either, I'd argue. And then you're looking at France, and you've already got Mbappe in there. Elise. Yeah. It's probably, maybe it is Elise, but I think his form over when it really came down to the crunch is, questionable. So I don't think there's any harm in it. Good to have a home nation player in there.
Yeah, it would have been Elise. Interesting enough, like, Kylian Mbappe is the only French player in this team. Somebody in the comments is saying, Robbo is saying, Martinez over Saliba.
Crying, laughing face.
Yeah.
As if to say, well, who's this guy?
Outrageous. Outrageous that I should include a player who got to the World Cup final.
Feel hard done by. Not that I put him in over Rodri.
He got whipped off a half time against Spain.
He was very good throughout the tournament, though.
Yeah.
Surprisingly good as well. A lot of people were writing him off before it started.
I would agree to a point, but I think that's because you don't expect much from Rabiot. You'd kind of be like, oh, geez, he actually wasn't useless.
No, I thought he was good, though.
Yeah.
I thought he played well.
I don't think he was better than Bellingham or Rodri, though.
No, I wouldn't have him in over, but he can feel a little bit hard done by, maybe.
Saliba going off as well in the Spain game with that injury was a big loss for them, too.
It was,
so I can very much see a reason for having him in. Yeah, definitely. It's a good shout.
And then finally, to finish off the team, up front, the robot, the star of the World Cup in the US, because he really did take off, Erling Haaland.
Yeah. Why is
that? We all know who he was. They didn't really know who he was. Now they do. And I think it's because he's... So, I don't know, do you watch his YouTube channel?
I don't. I just see clips.
Blogs his way around. And he just had like amazing viral videos at the time. But also, he's someone that Americans love to compare athletes to athletes in terms of like the crossover in NFL and basketball, and they were looking at this guy and they were like, he could play NFL, basketball, football, and be an Olympic sprinter all in one, and he's also this weird, interesting character.
He's very distinctive as well. Like, he became a bit of a heartthrob in America. Online.
Has he? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really? Along with Ferran Torres.
I know, I've seen the Ferran stuff. I haven't seen Haaland stuff, though.
You know, he's willing to sacrifice a headband so the locks will flow. Ferran Torres.
Yeah.
He doesn't mind taking out of his eye. It looks annoying for him.
I'm happy for him.
But he doesn't mind
it. I saw a few interviews floating around of Ferran with Pedri. I think it was when he's at Barcelona, and he was talking about, you know, no matter what Pedri does, they always praise him. But me, I can do no good and all this sort of stuff. And then,
recent as this season, he was looked at as someone that just couldn't finish. Like a half decent player, you know, for Barcelona. He's good on the ball, but he's no end product.
It's all about confidence, isn't it? His disallow goal was very well taken.
He's looked 1-1. Like he's,
that was after
yeah,
his first.
Looks yeah. like he's going to Paris Saint Germain as well to replace Calderamo.
Classic PSG.
That's such a good sign, too, if they do get it over.
Yeah.
I know people mentioned the Gavi situation after the match and how his final would be tainted. That goal to win the World Cup final is tainted forever because of everything that came in between before it and afterwards. People forget how... That was an amazing World Cup final goal win the tournament in extra time. Because of everything else, we will not remember it. Tim Nuttall is asking, what about the best player, 11 players outside of the finalists, those lesser teams with the odd special player? I will put that together
for tomorrow.
Later this week.
Maybe tomorrow. Back in the comments.
Maybe Friday. We don't want to give up on the World Cup stuff too early, especially because we have two and a half, three weeks to cover before the World Cup, before the Premier League kicks off again.
Bob, I had a word with Bobby D over the weekend.
He's back.
Okay. We needed him back, you know.
And he settled your differences.
Yeah. There was no difference. He's glad to be back. Martinez wasn't even the best Argentinian centre half. And you have to have Jed Spence at left foot.
He was very good.
He follows it up with
He was England's...
Is Jed going to Everton? Yeah.
DJ Ed.
DJ Ed.
They can't get rid of him. He's been too good. He's added a few. He's like... the tackle was amazing. I'm trying to... There's someone... I had someone in my head there of who he reminds me of, but he's gone now out of my head for some reason. But Bobby also followed that up with no bias, I swear, obviously being a Spurs fan. But he was pretty good. But just Cucurella obviously wins the World Cup and he's... He was brilliant.
Yeah, so there's no debate there. Then, are you thinking of Wan-Bissaka? Because that's who he reminds me of.
Yeah, maybe it is Wan-Bissaka,
Just the long limbs to make those tackles when you shouldn't be able to.
Not long ago that he was dropped by Neil Warnock.
Yes.
And was told he didn't have what it takes to be at the very top level. Gets promoted then, doesn't he?
Yeah, there was no. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he was at Borough and then he went to Forest and then got promoted and then was like posting pictures and referencing what Warnock had said. And then Forrest didn't want to pay the money for him or something. And then he went to Spurs. Spurs were looking for too much money or something like that. Yeah. 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 That was huge at the time because he was only really young then. He was like 20 or something. Yeah.
As we're in the World Cup aftermath, you're Pico Lopez in the back of the Irish Independent. My job is a footballer. Everything else is just noise.
What's that in reference to?
Yeah.
The amount of attention that Pico Lopez is receiving now.
Oh, so we're now at the stage where we're like, Concentrate on Shamrock Rovers, Pico. Stop doing ads.
Extremely Irish of us.
Yeah. Did you see his ad for
the curries?
For curries.
It's so good.
That's a good one.
They're playing tonight, I think, are they?
Connect a bit, you know.
Armenian team.
And the final football story for now. How about this, right? The Italian Eve sounding out Pep. Pep Guardiola has held talks with the Italian Football Federation about taking over as a new boss. Paolo Maldini, do you know this? Do you know that Paolo Maldini is the new technical director?
That's only as of a few weeks ago, I think.
Yeah, his advisor, Leonardo, understood to have travelled to Barcelona to speak to the Catalan coach about becoming the new Italian manager. So he had no interest in managing Spain, right?
Yeah.
What opens him up to a world of possibilities. He has previously spoken about his dream of managing Brazil, but they're no good these days. Whereas Italy, like, didn't qualify for the tournament, so it's a good job to get in terms of bringing them back to the tournament. And it was like, we'll start
only way
again.
It's up, yeah.
Would you take it if you were Pep? Or would you stay on football hiatus?
You know, if I was Pep, I'd let someone else take it for a little while.
See how
that goes. And then
whenever you want to make the call, I'll do it now.
Yeah, I would, yeah. Because, yeah, they're at such a low ebb. But then at the same time, you're getting in at the start of a new project with Maldini there and all that sort of stuff.
Have they ever had a non-Italian manager?
That's a smashing question. I would doubt it.
It'd be very un-Italian to have a foreign manager.
He's the only guy who breaks through that seal.
Yeah.
Don't know if he suits the Italian style of football, does he?
Really? Break it down there.
Listen, if they go
get the tactics board out.
Well, in terms of the tactical elements, he does, like, because he is at his heart a tactical, but defensively, I know he likes to be defensive by keeping the ball and being attacking.
Mm.
That goes against Italian principles of being defensive, solid first, and then figure out what you're going to do in attack. So
yeah,
whether that has an impact or not, who knows?
Do Italy have the players to play like that anymore? I don't know.
He could make them.
Yeah, I'm sure they've
he could make sorry, them. As in yeah. the old Italian way. I don't think they do anymore. So
yeah. One maybe for Richard Fitzpatrick imminently. In the meantime, guys, thanks very much for that enjoyable conversation. Nice one. I really appreciate that.